In a world that is experiencing the first impacts of climate change, one of the most significant transformations is occurring in the cryosphere. Glaciers, once emblematic symbols of snow's timeless accumulation, are now disappearing at an unprecedented rate, leaving a profound impact on our environment and communities.
Welcome to Series 2 of Mountain Voices. The audio you just heard to open this podcast comes from a video produced by UNESCO to mark the International Year of Glaciers Preservation 2025. Some stark messaging for a subject which deserves a deep dive in this episode. In this glacier special, we will hear from a number of glacier experts, including a documentary filmmaker and an experienced mountain guide. First of all, I'd like to introduce two Canadians, renowned international mixed and ice climber Will Gadd and Mary Sanseverino, a mountaineer and expert mountain studies researcher. For almost 15 years, Mary, Vice President of the UIAA Mountain Protection Commission, has been associated with Canada's long-running Mountain Legacy Project, which documents historic repeat mountain photography and landscape-level analysis.
This is the year. This is the UN International Year of Glacier Preservation. And for the first time, there will be a World Day for Glaciers on March 21st. So we thought it'd be a good idea to do a podcast all about glaciers and what's happening, what we can do about. And we're going to kick off with you two talking about the mountains of Western Canada. Now, if you're like me, your feed is probably full of these then and now slider shots of what the glacier looked like 100 years ago, even 50, 20 years ago. And, you know, the sad fact of what they look like today. Now, Mary, you're someone who's been heavily involved in that, photographing glaciers as part of the Mountain Legacy Project. So can you tell us how you got into that and what you were doing?
Yeah, well, actually, I have to start just a little tiny bit in the far back. I am a bush brat from Revelstoke, BC, or Revy, or the Big R, as it's known. And this is a town in British Columbia, and I like to think that it is one of the best mountain towns in Canada, maybe in the whole world. And I grew up skiing, sometimes, frankly, often, instead of going to school, hiking, climbing. And for a long time, I was the only girl in the climbing club. And I loved photography, especially mountain photography. And it really sort of jived together with all the things I like to do. But, you know, life sort of drew me away, took me away. And I ended up as a computer science professor at the University of Victoria. But one day, we had a professor, his name was Eric Higgs. His name is Eric Higgs. He's the principal of the Mountain Legacy Project. He came and gave a talk to our computer science unit, and it was all about the Mountain Legacy Project. And this essentially repeats historic mountain photographs from the Western Canadian Cordillera, or the entire Canadian Cordillera, and analyzes the changes and the similarities that we can see between those two images. And a lot of computer science goes into doing this, especially when you have to get those images aligned properly and to classify them, you know, like say, well, which part of this image is snow and which part is ice and which part is forest? And then getting the information from those images down onto 2D maps, that's all like a whole bunch of cool computer science in the background. I said, I want to be part of that. And put myself forward And then I spent about 15 years with Mountain Legacy, and I'm retired now, but I still keep my hand in with repeat mountain photography, and it helps me keep my focus now, which really is in mountain protection advocacy, especially in light of the challenges we're facing with climate change and biodiversity loss.
Can you give us an example of a mountain that you looked at, for example, Robson, and what were you doing? Would you just go up just to take one picture? Would you be there for like several days taking the same picture again and again?
Well, the team, it's never an individual. It's almost always a team, and the team will go out into a field season, which lasts, you know, a couple of months, 6 weeks, a week, whatever we get the money for, or whatever the team gets the money for and can do, off they go. So, for example, Will has got an essay in this book that Mountain Legacy is producing called Mountain Voices. And Will's photos are from the photos that he's used in his essay are from the Athabasca Glacier. And we've got a photo from 1917, a photo from 2011, and we got a new photo from 2023. So when we were there, we took not just one photo, but a round of photos, because the historic images were repeating. They're usually a panorama, and they were almost all created in aid of making maps in different areas. So that's, and we have thousands of them, over 100,000 in Canada. Canada's got a lot of mountains, and wasn't easy to make maps back at the turn of the 20th century, not with traditional methods. So that's why we have so many of these historic photographs.
Will, do you remember that trip?
Yeah, Athabasca Glacier. I mean, I've been going there since I was a little kid, and that's why I wrote about it for the book project. You know, when I was a little kid, you'd get out of the car and the glacier would be right there, a very short walk. And today you're walking for more than a kilometer to get to the glacier. And that's just within my lifetime. So I'm supporting efforts like the one that Mary's involved with and a bunch of other ones just to try and tell stories. You know, that I think what I've realized in the last 20 years of working for mountain preservation of one kind or another is that the science is for most people deadly boring. It's very hard to get somebody to care about a point, whatever temperature change. It doesn't resonate. But if you can show a picture of what the glacier used to look like, as Mary's been involved with, just a very short time ago, and now, then that's an emotional story, and that does resonate with people. So what I'm trying to do is make these glaciers into stories that will resonate with people, and hopefully, you know, have a bit more of an impact that way, because I think the climate change is fundamentally a huge risk. Like, it's a hazard. And so people don't respond to hazards intellectually. They respond to them emotionally and at a gut level. And so we need to do in our communications, I think, do a much better job of making this into a story that resonates emotionally. And that's how people tend to respond to hazards and problems, is with emotion. So I hope by writing and taking photographs and sharing those stories, that we have more of an impact, because what we have been doing isn't working.
It's difficult though, isn't it? I mean, even for those of us who do care and are aware, it's difficult not to be, you know, just feel like really impotent on what we can do. You see these stories, and you know, you've got those people who just deny, and then there are those who don't care, or those who think, well, it's the kind of fatalistic, in a mindset where you just think, well, hell, they're going, we may as well just have fun while it lasts. I mean, how do you make people care?
Well, I mean, I don't think you can make people care, but you've got to give them stories that resonate. And I mean, there's a lot of psychological research. I'm working on a book about how people deal with hazard right now. And the research says that they only care when it's emotional, and that emotion trumps facts, so to speak, at the moment, trumps facts and trumps everything else.
Yeah.
You know, so if you say a really scary thing over here, avoid that, then people, you know, respond to that. But if you're like, oh, the hypotenuse of the dangle of the quadricential, you know, lake plan, people fall asleep. So I think we have to make these stories emotional, because that's what the other side of this is doing. They're saying, right, if we take action here, you lose your job and life will suck. That's a really simple story. And we don't have stories to counteract that with. And these, you know, it's important. I think it has to be emotional, and it has to be obvious and graphic and immediate. And that's why taking these pictures and sharing the stories that we do is so important.
Yeah, and you know what? Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Tara.
I was just going to say, with the Athabasca, can you tell us why it's so important? And I think you were saying it's you know, it's not all over for the Athabasca. There is some hope you could at least save the Columbia rice fields.
Yeah. So the Athabasca is, I think, so you know, Canada is a country of ice rinks. But I think so. Yeah, we play a lot of hockey here. Winter's a big thing in Canada. And I think that the Athabasca is probably, maybe even more so than some of our famous hockey arenas, the most visited sheet of ice in the country. If you ask a Canadian who maybe doesn't know much about the mountains, about a glacier that they might know in Canada, I'll bet the Athabasca would be one of the ones. Because, you know, just like Will said, when I was young, because I'm a little bit older than Will, when I was young, it wouldn't be stop, Dad, I want to just walk over to the glacier. It would be literally stop, Dad, stop the car, Dad, I want to touch the glacier, because it was right there. So it's important in our psyche. It's important because it's the place where many people get to actually learn a little bit about glaciers and why they're important and how they work in the hydrologic cycle, how they work in the water cycle, and how even if you live in Vancouver, one of the big cities on the West Coast, glaciers are important to you. You might not know it. Just like, you know, many of us don't really know where our food comes from, I think that a lot of us don't really know where our water comes from. So it's an important story that way. We're probably going to lose the Athabasca. It's probably by the time, well, I like to say neither the Athabasca nor I are going to see out the 21st century. But the Columbia ice fields, the apex hydrology place, the place where when a snowflake falls, it could flow into one of three oceans. It could go to the Pacific, it could go to the Arctic, or it could go to the Atlantic. I mean, it's a very cool place to be in the country in so many ways. That might be saved if we can convince people through our stories that these glaciers mean something, not just to the Canadian psyche, but actually to the way we live our lives in Canada.
Will, do you have any optimism on the future of glaciers?
Well, as a good friend of mine likes to say, the everything is recycled in geologic time. And I think in geologic time, the glaciers will be fine. But I think in terms of human lifespan, certainly what I've seen from Kilimanjaro to the Andes, to the Himalaya, to the Alps, to the Rockies, what's optimistic? I don't have a lot of optimism that these glaciers in the kind of temperate areas of the world are going to be there a lot longer. And I think that's pretty clear. And it's, you know, Mary was just talking about the Athabasca, but I've been spending a lot of time there doing scientific research of one type or another or sharing the story. And there's an increasing number of people that you run into on that glacier. They run tours on the glacier. They drive these big buses down there, and then people wander out of the glacier beside these buses. And a lot of them are there to see the glacier before it's gone. It's kind of last chance tourism. And I think they're probably right. You know, it's whether they're from Germany or the UK or wherever they're coming from, they're right. We're in this kind of last chance to see readily accessible ice in a lot of these ranges. And at this point, I would really like it if the Athabasca were to stay there, but I don't think that's going to happen. And what we need to do is share these stories, because the problem isn't whether there's like one individual glacier or it's a little bit warmer here or there. You know, the world can do fine without climbers. We're not super necessary to the world. But as Mary just said, the water that comes from these glaciers, and, you know, where I live, we're very dependent on glacial water in our rivers. And nobody is thinking about, well, that's not true. Very few people are thinking about the problems that will ensue when we no longer have glacial water in our local river here. It's going to be a problem. And that is a problem for the farmers and for those of us who like to eat what farmers produce. So this is the problem. And it's hard to be optimistic right now, honestly, because I think it's pretty clear that we're on a bad path. So now it's about adaptation, and humans are very good at adapting. It's a difficult situation right now.
This isn't a story about climbers, mountaineers. You know, as you say, we're not important. But what have you done differently as a climber, mountaineer? What are you doing differently in the 40 years that you've been climbing? Are there places where you go to now that are completely inaccessible? Or,
well, every time I'm out in the mountains, I have to think about what's changed. And it's season to season. This isn't like, you know, every 40 years you go out and you're like, oh, there's a new rock. It's like, I can't walk up this glacier like I used to access this climb. And if you're a guide in the Alps, a lot of the refuges, the huts that you used to use require more infrastructure to reach them. If you want to go down and visit there, Jean-Tierre Glacier. They're building new cable cars continually. Like, this landscape is changing so fast. It's much higher hazard. We have to deal with rockfall and so on, that we just didn't have to. The permafrost that holds the mountains together is unpermitting itself. It's falling apart. And so we're getting a lot more hazards out there. But personally, 10 years ago, I was like, I need to change everything. And I made a pretty good shot at that in terms of my carbon footprint. And since then, I've decided that really what we need to do this at a much larger level. And I have some hope in that the solutions are becoming economically viable. Renewable energy is getting to be a lot cheaper now than non-renewable energy. And I think economics are probably going to drive the change going forward, not individual action. We need big scale change, and I think that's starting to happen. So I'm both very pessimistic about the glaciers, unfortunately, and kind of optimistic that with some of the renewables and some of the changes that are happening, I think there's the potential for a good path there. But we're in for a rodeo here, and I think it's important to recognize that and think about how we want to go about that.
Well, I'd like to say the same sort of thing. And of course, through my work with Mountain Legacy, it's like you're kind of living in a world of, Aldo Leopold, an environmentalist from the middle of the 20th century, said, when you've got an environmental education, it's like you live in a world of wombs. And when you get out and you do, and it's amazing to get out and do this landscape, this landscape change photography, this repeat photography, because you get to stand in places where few people have stood before. And of course, that's the thing about what we do as mountaineers. It's things that most of the world doesn't do. Less than 1%, well, around 1%, maybe 2% of the world population are alpinists. So we get to places that others don't. And I remember for myself, it was really shocking. The first time I lined up a photo, and it was, it was down in the Kananaskis country in the Rockies. And the first time I lined up a photo, and I'm looking at this historic photo, and I'm looking at the landscape, looking at the photo and the landscape, and I'm going, that glacier's gone. So it really hit me then. And then just this last year, I was out with a group of climbers in a really lovely area called the Campbell Ice Fields. And we were repeating images from 1917 or 1918 that Arthur Wheeler, one of the founders of the Alpine Club of Canada, had taken. And we were all absolutely gobsmacked, because the Campbell Ice Fields, this area still gets huge amounts of snow. It's world famous for its backcountry skiing. But to be there in the summer and to repeat there's a huge glacier and snowfield in there, or ice field in there, called the Campbell Ice Fields. It's not long for the world either. It's going to be gone. And it's really saddening. But I want to say one thing. I want to say one positive thing. We, as mountaineers, have a real opportunity in this International Year of Glaciers Preservation to advocate for change. We can use our platform for this. And one of the key purposes of the International Year of Glaciers Preservation, I think, is to allow us as mountaineers to hold space for glaciers as a symbol of why we need to take and call climate action. Mm-hmm. Now, the International Climbing and Mountaineering Federation, the UIAA, of which my federation, the Alpine Club of Canada, is a member, has approximately 94 member associations representing over 3.7 million mountaineers. Imagine the voice we could have if we all spoke as one on this. It'd be pretty damn powerful.
Excellently put, Mary. And tell me, are there any actual attempts in Canada to preserve glaciers? I mean, in Europe, some glaciers, we have actual blankets over them. And there are sort of little attempts, but you kind of wonder if this is going to make much difference. It might just prolong the inevitable.
I'm not aware of any in Canada like that. There's a done some very like cursory things with access areas and so on, but it's yeah, this is I don't see much of that. Like it is interesting being on the Argentière or some of the other glaciers I've been on where they put these white blankets over it. And it is interesting to see because you walk out there and the white blankets are anywhere from sort of 1 meter to 2 meters off the level of the glacier. Like it does work, but these projects seem to sort of fall apart. They're just really good examples of how much is being lost every year. You walk out there and the glacier's, head height where these blankets were on it, and that helped obviously, but you'd have to cover the entire glacier with that. It's just more of a stark reminder of how much we're losing every year right now. It's just really graphic. So I don't think it's really what they want to do. It's not really saving the glacier, but it is illustrating the point well.
While researching this podcast, I was wondering whether there was anything positive in all of this. And I mean, the only thing that I could think of was how that in at least in the European Alps, the glaciers are giving up some of their secrets. So there are some interesting things that are being found in the ice, whether that's the prehistoric man Ötzi, who was discovered a couple of decades ago, or it might be the mortal remains of a climber, loved someone from his family, and this is bringing a lot of comfort to families. Or it might even be the guy who found a bag of jewels on Mont Blanc. Do you know this story? Air India crash in 1966 went down, and not the first Air India crash. Actually, there was another one in 1950, but someone found 15 years ago a bag of emeralds, and it was valued at $250,000, and they got to keep half the money. That was the only positive story that I could think of. But I wonder whether the retreat helps to tell a part of our human story, our environmental story, if anything like this is happening that you know of where you are.
I don't think there's I don't people always want to look for the positive in this. It's like it's I think the positive is that these glaciers tell the story really graphically of what's going on, and that needs to be told. That's the positive in it. And once you get an eye for the landscape and where these glaciers used to be, I fly in them, I climb in them, I guide in them. I'm out a lot in these mountains, and you start to see what was. And it's that's the story that needs to be told. It's like this is real. And I always compare it to imagine that you showed up for work one day and half your office building was missing. How would you feel about that? As a guide in the mountains and as a climber in the mountains, that's what's happening to us. We show up, like where I go to work, it's completely different. I'm going to be back over in France working this year again on the Argentière Glacier. And I have to think, what is going, how am I going to do my job? What's the access like this year? Is there enough ice left that we can actually run these clinics at all? And so I think that's the positive, and I can show people that in those clinics, and I can share that. That's really important. And then at the same time, I also have to recognize that I'm a complete hypocrite. I'm flying around the world on a jet an awful lot. And that's how the world's structured right now. That does need to change. I fly less, I string trips together, but fundamentally, our way of life is probably not super sustainable. We have to come up with better solutions, and I hope we can.
I guess that it is tough when you see this loss, when you see landscapes that you played in, you stayed in, you worked in, you loved, and you see these immense creature almost things, although they are not. I don't want to anthropomorphize the glacier, but you see them and you see them disappearing almost in front of your eyes in some cases. It's hard not to feel really sad and disheartened. But I think that as these glaciers are melting away, that they can really be sentinels to put climate change back higher on our agenda. Like, I don't know whether, I mean, this is probably just me, but I think right now that climate change has fallen off the agenda here in Canada as much as I would like to see it elevated. And it is certainly fallen off the agenda. It's been pushed off the agenda in the big neighbor to our south, the United States, with the new administration there. It's like it's gone. We need to have something that brings this back, that brings climate change back in front of people. And I think that this is a perfect time for the International Year of Glaciers Preservation, and it's a perfect time for us to get out and tell our stories. Even if you're just telling it to Aunt Maud across the dinner table, or if you're getting to do like we're doing right now, having a podcast that's going to go out to thousands of people, or even bigger, we get to go to COP and, you know, the climate conference and tell our story there. We've got to tell our stories, and we've got great stories to tell. We've got compelling stories to tell. They've always been compelling, and they're going to be compelling going forward because few people get to where we get the privilege. Of course, yeah, there's a lot of skill and training and hard work that goes into it, but it's still a privilege to be able to get to the places we get to and do the things that we do. We got to tell about it more.
That's a great, great note to leave it on. You said, well, there was nothing to be optimistic about. Well, I'm feeling a lot more optimistic, maybe not optimistic, but more positive after listening to you two. Will Gadd, Mary Sanseverino, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
And a reminder to check out our social channels for more glacier stories and anecdotes from those impacted by glacier retreat.
I've spent years filming dying glaciers. This is the message I want the rest of the world to hear. Temperatures have risen and fallen naturally until we humans started to burn fossil fuels and heat the planet. By exploring these glaciers, I hope to inspire the next generation to be the voice of change.
What do we want?
What
do we want it?
If we don't act now, our children will look at our generation as the one that failed.
I want my grandchildren and great-grandchildren to have the same beautiful earth that we have now.
There's still time. This is the moment to save our world.
So this podcast is all about glaciers. And for the next part, it's our great honor to have the writer and director of the film The Last Glaciers with us. Craig Leeson, great to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here and talking about mountains.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to make this film, The Last Glaciers. Why did you want to tell this story?
So my background is as a journalist. I became a documentary filmmaker because I wanted to tell long-form stories. I saw a greater value in that than working for television news, where you create a two-minute story that's gone and never to be seen again. So I've created many films working with National Geographic and many of the big cable studios back in those days, and became independent and saw value in being able to create films that could go on many different platforms and be seen by more people. And had success through a film called A Plastic Ocean, which was the first film in its day to look at the global problem of single-use plastics in the oceans. But it became a human health documentary in the end, as we went out to see what was going on and investigate it, because there was very little science about it. Then the film kind of pivoted. The same story actually happened with The Last Glaciers. We were going to make a film about an extreme sport called para-alpinism, of which at the time very few people were engaged in, probably 50 on the planet. And it was because a good friend of mine, Malcolm Wood, is a paraglider and speed winger and mountaineer, and he thought it might make a very interesting documentary, and he took me into the mountains. I'm an oceans guy, not a mountains guy, and showed me the sport, and I was taken by it. It was exciting, thrilling, dangerous. It had all the components that I thought might make a really interesting documentary.
It looked like you had some bad landings, some quite tough landings as well.
We did, yeah. There was a steep learning curve, actually, as it took place.
The film opens with you're on a tandem flight with Malcolm, and you have a quite a hard landing coming down, and I think there might have been a few swear words as well uttered.
That was very challenging. That was in a peak in Peru, and we were flying at high altitude and some of the first people to be doing it, and in fact the first people to survive flying off that peak in a tandem paraglider, but only just. And we wanted to show some of those aspects, to show people the challenges that we personally were facing, which was an analogy to the challenge that humans are facing with the issue of global warming and melting glaciers.
And what did you discover during filming? What were the scientists telling you?
Yeah, well, when we decided to pivot the film from an extreme sports adventure film to a climate film, the reason was because when we got into the mountains, they were brown. They weren't white in the middle of winter, particularly in the French Alps. And so I started asking scientists questions about this, and they were telling me, and locals, in fact, guides and mountaineers were telling me that this had been going on for decades. And we were reaching a point where there soon would be no snow left and no glaciers, particularly on the lower peaks. And so I went to a scientist called Jérôme Chapelles, who was the head of Glacier Clim, which is the oldest science ice institute in the world and based in Grenoble, and asked him some questions about this. And he said the data is absolutely pointing to this, particularly through a program they were running called Ice Memory Project. And that's where scientists are going around the world. They're drilling cores deep into glaciers. They're pulling out these records of history, and they're taking those frozen bubbles, which contain the gases that were in the atmosphere at the time those glaciers were formed. And this goes back a million years. So they were able to accurately tell how much CO2 was in there, methane, oxygen, nitrous oxide, even the temperature of the atmosphere at that time. And it painted a very clear graph, which they had created, which shows this natural oscillation of the Earth's atmosphere going back a million years until 160 years ago when we started burning fossil fuels, and all of these gases just spike off the graph and go vertically. So we're able to tell when the problem started and who's responsible. And that correlates directly with the melting of the glaciers.
And during the film, you have this, you keep going to the swimming pool to illustrate how much water is lost. While you're watching the movie, I think there's something like 50,000 Olympic swimming pools of water are lost by the time you get to the end of the movie. Is that right?
Yeah, well, as a director, I'm very visual, and I find it really hard to visualize when a scientist said, well, we've lost 28 trillion cubic liters of ice in Antarctica over the last 30 years. I mean, what does that look like? What does that mean? It's such a big number. It's hard to visualize. So I wanted to show something that people could understand that was a little bit more reachable. And throughout the film, we wanted to show just in that 1 hour, 20 minutes of the film, how critical this is. So we've got sections as we go through the film where we list how much ice melt there has been off the mountains and into the world's oceans. And as you correctly pointed out, by the end of the film, it reaches 49,950 Olympic-sized swimming pools of water. And so I think that gives people a sense of not only the scale, but also the urgency of this problem.
What do you make of the UN initiative this year to make it the Year of International Glacier Preservation?
Well, I think it's correct and important, and it recognizes the importance that glaciers play to all of us. We partnered with the UNEP to make the film. We wanted access to their data as well, and we worked with some of their scientists in Geneva to get access to sea level rise data and glacial melt data and all that sort of thing, which we correlated with the data we got from the NASA scientists and the INECHEM scientists in Peru, the French scientists. And so they all paint a very similar picture. It is important. The hydrological cycle of these glaciers is so critical to human survival on the planet in terms of not just water storage devices, which we see them primarily as, but they're also climate regulators. They regulate the climate across the planet by reflecting radiation back into the atmosphere. And as they disappear, it exposes this deep brown rock, which does the exact opposite. And that is, it attracts heat and stores heat. And of course, as mountains heat up, they start to crack and move. And that causes problems not only for people who enjoy them for recreational activity, but also the high mountain communities that live in these areas. And we're seeing a lot of migration starting already in places like Peru, which will very shortly be without this glacial melt water. And in countries that rely on glacial melt water because they're deserts, and, you know, Lima is the 10th driest city on the planet, that without this water, they're in a critical position. And in fact, Peru has declared itself in a national water emergency because of the water that it's losing from the Andes.
In the film, you also look at the fires in Los Angeles from a few years ago. I mean, that feels very, very pertinent today.
There are many sequences that we made in the film that have come to fruition and actually become worse. The fires are one of them. Our executive producer, William Pfeiffer, who is a Hollywood producer and lives in Malibu, his house burnt down during those Malibu fires. And that was our HQ for developing the script and the idea. So I spent a lot of time in that home and, in fact, was in Los Angeles when that happened. And William was there as well. And so I visited with him and said to him, look, this is an example of how climate warming can affect anybody. It's not just the global South that suffers from this. It affects affluent and influential people around the world, such as yourself. So we need to film this. So we filmed him going back to his house to witness the absolute destruction. It was completely leveled and just reduced to 6 feet of ash. And he lost absolutely everything except, amazingly, a small urn that we found 2 feet under the ash, which contained his mother's ashes. And it was absolutely significant. But of course, it gave the sense of the fact that this crisis can touch anybody. And we've had several stories like that occur, such as, for example, the retreat of glaciers in Peru is leaving mineral rocks exposed for the first time, and they're oxidizing. And as they oxidize, nickel, lead, cadmium, these are minerals that haven't oxidized before, so they're changing composition, they're leaching into the river systems, and they're polluting the river systems that the farmers and agricultural community have used for absolute centuries that they can no longer use again. And this is starting to happen once again all over the world. So we looked at a lot of stories and issues that we thought could happen or could become bigger issues, and in fact they are. And once again, I think it delivers that sense of urgency for why we have to take this seriously and start to mitigate the problem.
What are you hoping to achieve with the film, and what do you think needs to be done?
First and foremost, we wanted to get awareness. And when we started making the film, in places like the United States, for example, only 35% of people polled actually thought climate was an issue or were actually in denial. Since the film has been finished, that number thankfully has increased, but there's still a great deal of denialism when it comes to climate. And we're seeing administrations coming into play now in places like the United States. In Australia, for example, we had an administration for 10 years, Conservative administration, who refused to acknowledge it. And so it was important to get that awareness across to show that the only thing that we should recognize when considering climate is the data. The data doesn't lie, and particularly when it comes from people who have spent their lives studying this issue, who use technology that is incredibly accurate, then what they're reporting to us with increased urgency is fact-based. It's not based on a belief system. You can believe in the Easter Bunny, you can believe in Santa Claus, but you can't. You don't believe in climate. It's data-driven. So we want people to understand that the data is what they should be focusing on. We made the film. We continue to make the film with an adventurous spirit to it and with the aspect of mountain climbing and alpinism in it, because we wanted people to go to see the film who wouldn't normally go and see a climate film. This film isn't made for scientists. It's not made for environmentalists. Those people already understand the urgency of this crisis. We wanted people to go and see the film and enjoy it for the adventure as well, to watch myself being taught how to reach 6,000 meter peaks and the trials and tribulations, including the crashes that I endure and others in the film go through. And we wanted to introduce the science within those stories so that people could get an understanding that what we were seeing and reporting on was fact-based.
What's the response been?
Incredible. We've had such a good ratings response and IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes from those who have seen it. Importantly, the scientists and environmentalists do see it as being a great tool to share with people. And the UN said that it was the most comprehensive film on mountain environments that they had ever seen. So we want organizations to take the film and to use it and to spread the message, particularly in this year of glacier preservation. It's the most important year. And we think the film covers all bases in doing that. It shows the importance for recreational use for people such as ourselves who just enjoy climbing mountains, but also for mountain communities, for governments, for the issue of migration as sea levels rise, which, you know, is another major problem of glacial melt, particularly as Antarctica starts to lose, you know, parts of the 70% of fresh water it holds on the planet. Then we're seeing sea levels rise. And if those areas lose all of their fresh water, we're going to see sea levels rise 60 to 80 meters. Most coastal regions can't even deal with the rising of 20 to 30 centimeters. And that's already causing problems around the world that we're seeing. So 60 meters is going to wipe out entire cities. And in fact, we start the film with a graph that shows the coastal erosion and the loss of these places. And we go into that in the film. So we think it's important. We'd love everyone to see it. We'd like them to help spread the message. And they can do that through the distribution method we've got, and to become actively involved. And they can do that by going to the website at www.thelastglaciers.com, where we have all the information there. And so it can also be used for schools and education purposes.
And is that where they can see the film, through the website?
They can see the film absolutely through the website or through links on my Instagram page or Malcolm Wood's Instagram page and others in the film, and the NGOs and influencers who we've brought on board and given a link to the film to help spread the message through their own databases.
Craig, it's been a real honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much and for sharing everything that you've been doing about glaciers.
Thanks so much for having us and sharing the story.
Why not check out our other episodes of Mountain Voices, including our special interview with rock climbing legend Adam Ondra.
So there's so much sandstone in Czech Republic. There are some places which are very good. And I think for me and most other climbers that like climbing there, there's also connection with the smell of the sandstone. So especially when you go climbing there in spring after the winter, it has this really nice smell.
So we're chatting now to Tom Harris, who is a guide from New Zealand. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. So you're going to tell us a little bit about your experience of a glacier you've known for many years, New Zealand's Fox Glacier. Tell us about the Fox. What makes this glacier unique and special?
Yeah, the Fox Glacier is a very unique glacier, mainly due to where it is and the climate that it interacts with and the landscape that it's in. So it's on the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand, which is, in terms of having glaciers there, one of only three places in the world that we see glaciers descending into temperate rainforest. So New Zealand, parts of Chile and Patagonia and southern Alaska. So it's an unusual place in the sense that in the summertime, you can be wearing shorts and a t-shirt and be ice climbing on the lower parts of the glacier. So really, really temperate climate. And basically the reason that that can exist is because that part of the country sees an enormous amount of snowfall in the upper sections of the glacier where the altitude's a bit higher. And so just an enormous amount of ice is created there, just a surplus of ice that then flows down the valley. So despite the fact that it's a warm climate and ice melts very quickly, the supply of ice from the upper glacier is so much that it's been able to exist for a very long time in a place that you wouldn't normally expect one to be.
Yeah. And what have you witnessed in the last few years?
Since I started guiding on the Fox Glacier in 2012, and then I stopped guiding full-time on the glacier in around 2018. And in that time, there was just constant retreat and quite rapid retreat. I believe during that time, so during about 6 or 7 years, the glacier retreated almost a kilometer.
Wow.
And it was thinning at the same time at a really rapid rate, particularly in the summertime. And that has only continued since I have moved on from working on the Fox Glacier. Yeah, just enormous retreat. And the glacier has a history of doing that from time to time, and it has grown at certain times. It's a very responsive glacier. So when you have periods in New Zealand with high snowfall or cooler temperatures, the glacier can advance. And when it's warmer or when it's drier, or you have different other sort of weather phenomenon happening, the glacier can retreat really fast. So it's a really responsive glacier. We used to tell our clients that the glacier normally will result to big climatic changes in New Zealand within 7 or 8 years. It's quite fast. And to give you a sense of like the life cycle of the ice on the glacier, in the center of the glacier where the ice is moving the fastest, it would only take about 80 years for the ice from the very top of the glacier to be formed and then reach the bottom of the glacier and melt. So it's quite a short life cycle. We're not talking about hundreds of thousands of years like in Antarctica. It's kind of like a human lifetime in terms of how long this ice can exist in the faster moving areas of the glacier. So it's a very, very quick moving dynamic glacier. And then in the last 10 to 15 years, it's constantly been retreating really rapidly.
And how's that affecting guiding operations on the glacier?
So it's affecting guiding operations massively because the glacier is constantly changing. And that's true when the glacier advanced in the past as well. It's like a constant battle between trying to figure out how you're going to get on the glacier is the main thing. And then trying to work around what's a safe area to be working on the glacier. The current problem, and what's been the problem for, since I've been working there, is because the glacier is retreating so quickly, the ice that used to occupy this valley is no longer supporting the mountainsides around the glacier. So as the ice moves down, there's no longer that sort of structural support for the walls, and rock just starts collapsing. And so you have enormous amount of rockfall in this valley, like daily rockfall. At times it's enormous. I recall a time about a year and a half into working on the Fox where I personally witnessed a rock the size of a 6-story building just collapse onto the glacier. It's just enormous size rocks that are coming down the mountain. That continues to happen today. It's even at a greater rate than it was in the past. And there are, because we're guides, we know the valley really well, and we have our sort of risk management systems to avoid these situations. But because the glacier is getting smaller at the same time, the safe areas that you can occupy to remove yourself from that risk become smaller and smaller, or further up the glacier and more technical to work in. It's a really dynamic valley. It's changing really quickly. And the easy and safe parts of the glacier to work on become smaller and smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking clients to somewhere where there are building sized rocks coming down is probably something you don't really want to do, is it?
No, like you just have to avoid those parts of the glacier. You don't know when that's going to happen, and you just have to avoid that risk.
So is it completely off limits now? Can anyone get onto the glacier?
Yep. So the glacier is still being guided on. But now the only way to get onto the glacier safely and to get to safe areas of the glacier is using helicopter access. So that's been the case since 2014, that is the only way that the glacier is accessed by the guiding company.
And does that feel a bit wrong?
It feels ironic in a sense. Climate change is one of the major contributor to why the glacier is retreating, and obviously emissions contribute to that. And while a few helicopters going up down the valley isn't the reason the glacier's retreated, it's contributing. But now that's the only way to get on safely. So that's, I think, something that the wider industry in New Zealand, there's a number of other glaciers that are guided on as well, and it's the same for all of them. You can only get on with helicopter now. It's a real sort of morally challenging element of the work, is that that's the only safe way to do it now.
What does the future look like? Can you give a sense of the mood among guides? Are you fatalistic? Is there any optimism?
So I don't work on Fox anymore, but I'm still in touch with people who work in that industry in New Zealand. I think we, as a guiding community in New Zealand, know that the way we've guided the last 80, 90 years in New Zealand has to change, regardless of what type of alpine guiding you're doing, whether it's on a glacier or if you're climbing Mount Cook or something like that. The nature of guiding is just changing massively in terms of the snow conditions you're going to experience, in terms of, you know, getting a good freeze if you want to climb Mount Cook and what season that's going to be, what seasons you're going to be guiding in general for different types of activities, and big one just being the prevalence of rockfall all across the Southern Alps of the South Island is just growing and growing, and it's only going to get worse as we have less ice locking up all that rock and more rainfall, stronger weather events. It's just going to make rockfall worse and worse. I know that's starting to happen in Europe as well, that they're getting more rockfall than they used to, but New Zealand's sort of another level because the rock that we have in the Southern Alps is particularly prone to that sort of thing. It's not a very well consolidated rock. So yeah, and as a wider industry, not just guiding on the Fox Glacier, I think we know the way we've done it in the past cannot be the way it's going to be in the next 30 years. We have to think of new ways to be guiding in the Southern Alps.
What might that look like?
I think it may turn into a lot more working with rock and working in different environments, being less focused on ice in the future, because it just won't be around or it will be too technical and dangerous. But to be honest, it's a really difficult question to ask. I don't think we have a really good answer just yet. And a lot of it has to do with the changing appetites of consumers as well in terms of what they want to do. But I wouldn't say we have a good answer at the moment what we're going to do. It's a bit tough to answer.
Yeah, it's a sad story. And one of the highlights of my climbing, you know, that I've ever done was a trip to New Zealand in June, climbing, you know, Mount Cook. And I remember, you know, looking back now, we flew in. You know, we landed up on the glacier there. Yeah, it's a very sad story if what's happening to the Fox is telling a story of what's happening across the country.
Yeah, I mean, what you experienced in Mount Cook, having to fly in, that's largely for the same reason that we have to fly onto the Fox to guide as well. It's because the access to Plateau Hut, where you probably began your climb, the only really, really safe way to get there is to use a helicopter. It is possible to get there otherwise, but it is really dangerous. There was a fatality there a few years ago from rockfall. So yeah, it's becoming a really challenging decision around access and safety, and then thinking about the environment. They're all a bit in conflict now.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your insights.
Yeah, no problem. Glad to help.
Thank you for listening to this deeply insightful episode of Mountain Voices. Hit subscribe to receive future episodes and to listen to previous ones. Mountain Voices is a podcast series from the International Climbing and Mountaineering Federation, presented and produced by Tarquin Cooper, co-produced by Peter Bourne, and edited by Tom Tushaw.